Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, episode 77. We're hunting wabbits.
This Week in Law is brought to you by Hover.com. Hover is domain name registration and management that's simple. For 10% off your new domain, go to twill.hover.com. And by squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off your new account, go to squarespace.com/twill.
Hello and welcome to This Week in Law. I'm Denise Howell. And today on TWiL, we've got a student, a professor, and two lawyers joining us. So I'm really excited about this. Our student is Justin Silverman. He is at Suffolk University Law School and writes the Suffolk Media Law Newsletter, which is just fantastic, has more stories than we could ever cover in TWiL unless we just took over the TWiT stream for the entire day. Maybe we'll do that someday. But we would need Justin to do it because he is the man with all the stories. Welcome to the show, Justin.
Thanks, Denise. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. Look forward to it.
It's a pleasure. How do you find time to do all that with your classwork, et cetera? I bet your professors are.
Classwork and a full-time job. I don't sleep is really the short answer.
Lots and lots of Jolt Cola, I see.
Absolutely.
Yes. All right. Well, on the professorial end, we have Sheldon Toplett from down the road from Justin, also in Boston, over there at Boston University. Hello, Sheldon.
Good afternoon, Denise.
Sheldon teaches media law and journalism at BU and is often featured in Justin's newsletter. So we're thrilled also to have you with us, Sheldon. Are you teaching both courses this year?
Yes, I am. And I actually also teach at a First Amendment course at Emerson.
Great. Well, hopefully we have stories that will touch on all your areas of expertise today. And with us too, fresh from his stint guesting on CNN last weekend, is Evan Brown from Chicago. Hello, Evan.
Hey, how's it going? Good to see you. Happy Friday.
Good to see you too. And I want to jump right in. I'm going to follow my own advice, drink my own Kool-Aid, eat my own dog food, and lead with porn for the day. Yay!
Right on. We finally
never go wrong with that.
I know, we've never actually done it. So let's jump back into that Craigslist story that you chatted about on CNN last weekend, Evan. And let's just, tell Craigslist that they're welcome for taking our advice on the last TWiL when we mused about why they didn't just take the adult services section down, given the flack they're taking for it. They did, but they did so in a rather strident and statement-making sort of way. Evan, why don't you tell us what's been going on and what's the latest?
Well, of course, this has been going on for quite some time. The attorneys general across the country have been expressing their discontent with Craigslist, maintaining what it used to be called the erotic services section, then since 2009 called the adult services section. And, you know, there's actually been some litigation over this here in Chicago. You know, the sheriff of Cook County filed a civil lawsuit, which is a kind of a unique thing for a sheriff to do, filing a civil lawsuit for nuisance. And that was dismissed by the district court here in Chicago. There is some litigation going on in South Carolina over this, where Craigslist is trying to preempt some of the stuff going on with these grumblings. So this is a story and a controversy that's been developing for the better part of a couple years, if not longer. And Craigslist last weekend, within hours after our show, which leads us to think clearly that it was as a result of our show, right?
Of course. What's the Latin post hoc ergo propter hoc?
Right, so, right.
Yeah.
obvious causation with that very correlation. So they disabled access to this adult services site and did it in a kind of a unique way, or a way that has gotten even more attention than what it would have if it had just quietly gone away. They put a black band over where the link used to be on the Craigslist homepage, and there, written across it, is the word "censored." And as I've talked about this before, and as what other people who spend a lot of time talking about this stuff have also observed, the Craigslist's motives in doing this really are unclear. Who knows why they're being that way? Why they're saying censored like that? But clearly, it's it could be that they're trying to be defiant, saying, "Look at us, we are we're being called out, we're being silenced, and all of this stuff." But we're giving in, but we're not going to go gently into that great night when it comes to this section here. So that's where we are, and there's plenty of ways, branches, paths that this discussion can go down, talking about all the implications of this, not the least of which, we talked about with Professor Goldman on the show last week when we were here, saying, there's a certain benefit of having the adult services section up on Craigslist, because that could indeed make the job of law enforcement easier. So far from it to say that it's obvious that disabling access or removing this section of Craigslist is, at in the final analysis, a good thing. So that's where we are factually, this day and age.
Right. With the one addendum, I think yesterday they actually took the censored statement block button down. At least
well,
I
you
have
see,
a story.
I had been hitting refresh nonstop, waiting for the section to come back. It's really wrecked my social life.
I'm sure. So, what are folks to do?
But by Wednesday evening, I had given up. So I'm glad that you stayed with it and can make that observation.
Yes, I plan not to give up at all, because what's a poor lawyer in Orange County, California, to do without the Craigslist adult services site? But yes. Anyway, it does seem that their statement is over, but that the adult services have not been reinstated. They just took down the black armband, if you will. Justin, have you been following this? And what do you think happens next? Let's jump off from the comment Evan made, remembering that Professor Goldman last week told us he thought, maybe this is actually shooting law enforcement in the foot, because they're not going to be able to have a centralized place, a ghetto for this kind of stuff, at least not this centralized place. What do you think?
Well, I think where do we go next? I think we see a number of other sites picking up where Craigslist left off. I mean, personally, I'm a bit disappointed. I was in for the fight. Involved in these listings were protected speech, and it really doesn't sit well with me that attorneys general can pressure a website like Craigslist to take down these listings when much of that speech was protected. Craigslist seemed to be doing everything it could within its power to weed out those listings that did facilitate illegal activity. So I gotta say, I'm pretty disappointed. But where do we go from here? I mean, I think you're gonna see very similar listings on other sites. In fact, I think we already do. I think Gawker has a one service that is similar, backpage.com, I believe I read. I haven't visited, but I think that's a similar listing as well. You're going to see people pick up where Craigslist left off. So as far as a law enforcement perspective, I mean, it's disappointing in that I feel like they just stomped out hundreds or thousands of leads that they could have used for their own benefit, and Craigslist could have been involved and been this great advocate for the cause. But those leads are going to pop up elsewhere.
I haven't finished listening to Twit from last Sunday, but I think that Leo highlighted a site that was aggregating all of the alternatives to the Craigslist adult services site. So somewhere out there, someone is struggling to make sure everyone knows where to go. Sheldon, reflecting on your knowledge and experience with the First Amendment, I late added to our discussion points a long essay over at EFF by Matt Zimmerman about why this is protected speech, or this section that has been taken down is protected speech, and why this truly is censorship. Then, what are your thoughts on those lines?
Well, it's certainly, first off, I guess Justin and I are somewhat tainted since we live in the state where the so-called alleged Craigslist killer dwelled, and where this whole thing started. Craigslist, one of its greatest sins, unfortunately, is to have this happen during an election year. And I think as they really haven't changed, you know, is what they've been doing in the last year or so, and the amount of illegal or, you know, illicit activities in the adult service section, it hasn't really gone up or measurably or whatnot. It's just a matter of circumstances that have you know, thrust them, put them into this position. But yeah, I mean, I think I would agree with Justin that, you know, it's commercial. You know, commercial speech may be not as it's more subject to regulation than so-called pure speech, you know, newspaper copy. But it's nonetheless that there has to be a legitimate state, you know, interest in why they're doing it, and they can't throw out the baby with the bathwater, and I think that's what they're doing here. And the real danger, I hope this doesn't happen, is that it is you know, spawns a further attempt maybe to go take a look at Section 230 of the you know, Communication Decency Act. It's this shield that is protected internet service providers and whatnot, and say, you know, you're not to be treated as a publisher or a speaker. And, you know, there's been talk in Congress about you know, looking at that, and I think that would be problematic, because it, you know, well beyond Craigslist, it protects, you know, news organizations and Facebook and you know, Blogspot and other otherwise. So I'm hopeful that it doesn't go beyond that. I've also read somewhere about an organization called the Fair Fund that was talking about a class action suit against Craigslist over this issue, and so there's no you know, we may just be seeing the tip of the iceberg here, but I think clearly you know, this is a you know, it is a protected speech. It appears elsewhere. Being in Boston for the longest time before we went on to the internet with Craigslist and other outlets like that, the news, the weeklies here, the Boston Phoenix, the adult section was the adult services and escort section, the most widely read part of the paper. And so, you know, I mean, you can't legislate this stuff away. You can't make it go away.
Evan, over here in Matt's post at EFF, he says the ability to encourage speech of all sorts without fear of legal reprisal is a feature of the CDA 230 world, not a shortcoming, one that encourages the publication of a diverse range of viewpoints and not just those of rich and cautious media companies who can afford the financial risk of publication. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with Sheldon that as these things seek protection under Section 230, lawmakers may decide to alter that section?
Very much so. And I remember having thoughts similar to what I'm having right now when a couple of years ago, the Ninth Circuit handed down the roommates.com decision, which was, of course, an important Section 230 decision. My concern is that if we were to ever actually get to a situation where the issue of Craigslist liability for these for this conduct, for allowing this type of content to be put through its site, if we got, let's say, all the way up to a court of appeals on this, and the court of appeals held that, yes, Craigslist is scot-free, you know, is not responsible at all. There are children being trafficked, kidnapped, murdered. People are being murdered. All of this stuff happening, and Craigslist is in the position to stop it. You know, note, I'm being very hyperbolic here on purpose here. If we got to that point, you know, that would be a really easy political target for people to say, what on earth is this Section 230 thing. You know, politicians and people who haven't given it serious thought like we have, and you know, the layperson perspective of it perhaps, and think, you know, something's got to be done here. I mean, I can't even keep track of the smart attorneys that I talk to all the time who, when they're presented with a factual scenario where they are representing somebody who's being defamed, they cannot for the life of them understand why they can't hold the website responsible for that. They become blind to the benefits of having the intermediary be immune from that kind of liability. Just imagine if that factual or if that conclusion from a court made it into you know, something as high profile as what this whole dispute has been, there would be a real public outcry. That would really call for Section 230's head. So in that vein, I think that's one way that we can look at Craigslist's relenting here at this point in time as a good thing, because this is something, given all the other stuff that's going on in the world, this story in the scheme of things was more likely to go back under the radar and go back out of the people's top of mind consciousness when we've got, you know, people threatening to burn copies of the Quran and all of that stuff. There are other things that that people are going to be thinking about, and it will put the protections of Section 230 a little bit further out of peril's way.
It's never been that popular a section anyway, Jerry. You know, the Drudge AOL Blumenthal case, you know, the judge in that case was had all kinds of problems with not being able to hold AOL's feet to the fire, but said, well, you know, that's what Congress said, you know, and he had trouble with it. And of course, you know, people who are familiar with the AOL Zarin case are outraged that this guy who was a subject of a really cruel hoax, a prank, you know, had no recourse against AOL. So, it's been one of those things. It's never been all that popular in the first place. So I agree with Evan. Things could get out of hand.
There's no Section 230 case that I can think of that don't have or that doesn't have at its core some pretty rotten facts where somebody has done somebody wrong, you know, whether it be defamation or some kind of negligence. I mean, you know, there's the Doe versus AOL case from the Supreme Court of, I think it's the Supreme Court of Florida from a few years ago that involved child porn. Right. You know, so it's rotten. You know, discrimination, the roommates.com case, the Craigslist case here in the Seventh Circuit about discrimination. You know, these are all rotten things. And, you know, when we stop and think about it, you know, maybe it is remarkable that it has held up this long. But I think we should thank our lucky stars for it, because I am convinced that it's really been instrumental in the development of the infrastructure of the web, making people feel comfortable in making these kinds of investments in that.
Well, Professor Goldman was quite comfortable that Craigslist could invoke Section 230, and we've been sort of taking that for granted. But doesn't the section specifically carve out a number of things, including intellectual property and criminal activity? Or is it only federal criminal activity? Why does this apply here?
I think it's just federal criminal activity, and then there is an exception for intellectual property infringement. And there's actually, you know, I didn't study up on this particular issue. I hope some other folks on the call can help me out with this. But there seems to have been some different courts have said different things, whether that refers to state intellectual property laws, like, you know, right of publicity, mm-hmm. or whether it has to be, because I think wasn't that the one of the Perfect 10 cases addressed that issue maybe back in 2007, and so. I think it just says that Section 230E, I think, is where that exception is for intellectual property. It just says intellectual property, and some courts have said that means federal claims for federal intellectual property. But I think it's pretty clear. We ought to look that up about it being an exception for federal criminal prosecution. So my thought has been, if there were some kind of federal cause of action that one could make against Craigslist, then there might be a problem here. And it led me to think, what kind of federal cause of action could there be? And I can't really think of anything right away. But do you remember from law school talking about, this was an act that was repealed, the Mann Act? Do any of you remember that?
Oh,
absolutely.
Sure,
yeah.
Sure.
Well, it was something about you couldn't take...
I was always taking minors across state lines, so yes, that was...
All right. But did it even apply to my, this is, again, I should have studied up on this before bringing it up, but I know it was ruled unconstitutional, like on the grounds of vagueness, because I think for one, it applied only taking women across state lines.
That's right.
And I think
right.
it was real vague, like saying just for whatever immoral purpose or something like that. So that's I don't right. think there's anything like that anymore to trump up a federal cause of action for what Craigslist is doing. But while you guys are talking, I'll look up Section 230 about this, get the particular language of this exception here.
Right. Sheldon, can you shed any light for us? Are you more up on the particular exceptions than we are?
Well, I think he's done a really good job. Justin is probably the guy to talk about this.
Yeah, Justin?
Though I'm not familiar with the Mann Act, I do think the point about Section 230 is a good one. And especially in the context of this case, I mean, you do have this push against Section 230, but if we're going to put any dents in that armor, I'd rather it be done with cases where there's actual unprotected speech, whether it's anonymous poster defaming someone else, where the speech itself isn't protected. And I don't believe that the majority of the speech that we're talking about in this case falls into that category. And I guess it won't occur now because of Craigslist action and taking the service down. But I would have hated to see some kind of decision come down that would have reduced the protection that we have under 230 because of protected speech.
Right. And I also put in our discussion points, which folks can access at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/77. This is episode 77 of our show. Jeff Jarvis's post at Buzz Machine, where he definitely says that he is not suggesting a conspiracy. He rarely does, but he sees old power structures huddling together against the cold breath of technologists bringing change. And he has an interesting post here about why Craigslist is being singled out for this when, as we've discussed a little while ago, it is certainly not the only resource for locating this kind of service online. So that's an interesting point. Evan, any thoughts on the large media establishment versus upstart technology companies in this context?
I have to admit, I wasn't listening to your question because I was reading the Wikipedia article about the Mann Act.
Well, let me shoot it over to Sheldon then.
Well, I think specifically about the concept that this is a traditional media striking at the new media, or the government going after or a backlash against just a big player like Craigslist, I want to make sure I got specifically which point it is that.
Yeah, no, I think the point here is that he's. He points out the New York Times article that sort of belittled Craigslist's posting of the word censorship and calling it a stunt or a ploy without ever really pointing out that it has a dog in this hunt too, right? I mean, Craigslist as the complete dominating force in classified ads nationally and internationally today, is undercutting on a routine basis the New York Times revenue stream and business model. He's not suggesting that the New York Times or the government is seeking to topple them. He's pointing out an interesting dichotomy here. And from your media background, I wonder how you think that plays out.
Oh, well, there's no question. I mean, that the just in terms of, I blog about this all the time, that the traditional print media has lost, besides circulation, has lost all its ad revenue to sites like Craigslist and to the monster as far as the job listings that used to be so important to newspapers' classified sections, or real estate listings, automobile listings. All of them have gone to specialized online sites. And at the same time, as these traditional print outlets have set up their online editions, they're still struggling as finding ways to generate advertising lineage online. So I'm sure there's no love lost there, but whether it's some grand conspiracy, I might go that far.
Right. Evan, anything you want to share with us about the Mann Act before we move on to something else?
Yeah, it's this would have been spot on. This has been the way to get Craigslist if it hadn't been ruled unconstitutional. It was better known as the White Slave Traffic Act, and it applied to all females of any age. It made it unlawful to transport a female across state line for, quote, immoral purposes. And there were also some interesting prosecutions under it. You know, some of the Mann Act defendants include Chuck Berry, who was convicted in 1962. Charlie Chaplin was acquitted in 1944. Charles Manson was convicted for taking a couple prostitutes from California to New Mexico. And none other than Frank Lloyd Wright was arrested, but he was the charges were dropped. You know, who knows what Frank Lloyd Wright was doing. So this would have clearly been a criminal cause of action, criminal prosecution that would have gotten around Section 230 immunity if it were still on the books.
Well, there you go. Unfortunately, we don't see that in play, so I'm not sure what's going to happen there. We are having a bit of a sound issue, Burke. And I'm not seeing you in our Skype chat right now, so I'm just going to mention it and hope that it works itself out. Ah, there you are. Sheldon, if you could turn down your speaker or monitor, that will help matters considerably, we hope.
Sure.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Great. Thanks very much. So let's see. Where was I going with this? Well, let's move on to... I think that a good number of the folks using the adult services ads on Craigslist were appreciative of the ability to do so anonymously. And we've seen a lot of courts more and more trending toward revealing the identity of anonymous speakers online. Evan, you had a post about the Quickstar case, and I think we talked about it maybe one or two episodes ago. Why don't you bring us up to speed on what's going on there, and then I want to get all your opinions about what's happening generally with what's the state of anonymity online right now, and what sort of faith can people have in remaining that way as they journey around the web. So, Evan, what's this recent case?
Well, this one, as you said, came from the Ninth Circuit, and what it held was that the lower court went too far. It's the standard that it held to determine whether or not some unknown speakers should be unmasked. That standard was too high. The lower court in this case applied a standard from the New Jersey State Court from a case called Dendrite, and it also looked to. It was the Doe versus Cahill standard, which requires a party to put up enough facts at the beginning of a lawsuit when it's asking the court to unmask an anonymous defendant, enough facts to survive a hypothetical motion to dismiss. And it held that that was too high of a standard, too stringent in this case, because the speech at issue involved commercial speech. There was the dispute in this Quickstar case was about it was like, you know, an unfair business practices type of civil lawsuit, and so all of the statements had to go to certain commercial expression. So that looking to the standard that applies to that type of speech, the court recognized that that's not entitled to as strong of a First Amendment protection. So it was only required to look at it in those terms, and that it was appropriate that therefore that the speakers be identified, some of the speakers be identified. If I could just comment kind of on the general landscape of this area of the law, it seems to me the impression that that people are getting is that this right to anonymity seems to be eroding, because in a lot of these cases, the unknown speakers are indeed unmasked. The reason I think that impression may be coming to our consciousness is that most of the cases that we see involving unmasking anonymous speakers deal with commercial speech. It's relatively unusual to find one that deals with political speech. The Doe versus Cahill case is an exception to that. It was from Connecticut back in 2005, and there were some forum board posts by an unknown speaker who was talking about local politics. So to me, it seems that, to the extent that there is this apprehension that the right to anonymity is eroding, it's really because of the nature of these cases. So many of the factual scenarios that I come across in my practice and talking with other lawyers who are working on cases that involve defamation online and anonymity deal with the obvious culprits, sites like Yelp, that's always seeming to be coming up. And incidentally, they got a pretty big victory recently on Section 230 grounds, kind of tying it back to what we were talking about earlier. So no doubt this is a very important issue because of the constitutional interests that are at stake here. There's clearly a First Amendment right to speak anonymously, but that First Amendment right is not immutable, and it's not subject to very important limitations, most notably in situations that we often see where the complaint of speech is defamation.
Sheldon, I want to ask you a few questions about this, but I want to make sure that if you are listening to the live stream of the show, you have that turned down or just turn it off.
I'm not listening to it.
Okay. And are you on a speakerphone?
No. I have it right up to my ear.
That's strange because we're getting an echo only when you're on, but hopefully we can sort that out after the fact. Okay. But here I want to get into these anonymity problems. Maybe what we'll do is call you back, and that could fix your audio.
Absolutely. I'll sit right by the phone.
Okay, we'll do that. And in the meantime, I'll ask Justin. There have been a number of cases on this issue about whether it's important to protect people's anonymity or important for safety, security, and accountability reasons not to. And a number of media organizations seem to be... there we go.
Okay.
Still hearing the echo.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like me, though. I mean, I don't know. I hear when I'm not saying anything. But now it's actually gone. I don't hear it. So maybe we willed it away.
Okay. Well, we'll just see how it goes. But setting up this question, we've had a bunch of cases kind of all over the map on this. Some have found that it's important to preserve people's anonymity. Some have found that it's important to, in certain circumstances, for security or accountability kind of reasons, to make the anonymity go away. And a bunch of media organizations are making changes. Marbent in the chat room points out that the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, the CBC, is changing its policy about whether people can comment anonymously. So
the Buffalo News, actually, was the only newspaper that Warren Buffett owns. They no longer allow anonymous comments to stories in their online edition. So, yeah, there have been a lot of policy changes by the media, stuff happening outside the courtroom as well as inside.
Right. So do you think that that affects what happens inside the courtroom as these cases continue to come down on both sides?
I'm not sure that I think it's a, I don't know if it's laziness. I'm not quite sure why it is that the traditional newspapers, are changing their policies. I really don't see it as, they think it's it's almost like a housekeeping thing in a way. I mean, they feel like, well, they have to have people, paying attention to what's coming in. But it's really no different than the letters to the editor that used to come in snail mail. You get something, if it's offensive, you don't run it. And then likewise, these comments, anonymous comments, you remove them right away. And I don't think it's really not that big a deal. I think it's an overreaction by the media. But within the court, obviously Evan cites a lot of commercial speech, but there have been plenty of, it is the Wild West all over the country, different things happening. Over in, you had the great Elmer Fudd case down in, Carolina. What was it? North
Carolina.
You
have to tell us about the Great Elmer Fudd case.
Oh, well, this was, presumably it wasn't his real name. This was the Sun News over in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. And there was the Sun News of Myrtle Beach, the newspaper, received these, you know, they had these anonymous bloggings from somebody under the pseudonym of Elmer Fudd. And, you know, he made some, you know, false postings about, you know, suggesting that the county sheriff's office had raided the local chamber of commerce and seized computers and whatnot. And the sheriff's office denied it and whatnot. So the Chamber of Commerce brought a suit, and they asked that, you know, they subpoenaed the newspaper for the identity of this fellow, and the newspaper itself wasn't a party to the suit, but they got a subpoena, and they basically, you know, I guess they have an agreement with the you know, newspapers often do, you know, with the speakers. They basically said, we're going to roll over, we're going to produce the screen name and the internet provider address to the chamber unless they receive a response from FUD, you know, indicating his intent to contest the subpoena on First Amendment grounds. But, you know, failing that, they were going to, give it up. But there have, you know, really been all over the place. Just in North Carolina, and in Pennsylvania, just in the last couple of weeks, you know, there are just rulings of all kinds, and sometimes it's in a business situation, but other times not. Over in North Carolina, there was a judge who ruled that the Freedom Communications owned publication, the Gaston Gazette, did not have to reveal the identity of an anonymous commenter who had, you know, made some remarks in an online article about a murder suspect. Over in Ireland, the Ireland High Court last month has allowed the Irish Red Cross to go after to track down an anonymous blogger, and so, you know, it's sometimes they say yes, sometimes they say no. It really is hard to know what the basis is. There have been plenty of things down in Evans' neck of the woods. There was the Alton Telegraph tried to invoke the state shield law to withhold the identities of anonymous bloggers on their website, and that didn't fly. So there have been lots of cases, and it's really unsettled. But I think we are moving further away from the Supreme Court case. Well, I think it was the McIntyre case, if I'm not mistaken. Justin, you're probably more up. You're still getting tested on cases. You're probably more up on. But the McIntyre case, I think, was 1995, and that was one that basically upheld, you know, the importance of the right to retain your anonymity under the First Amendment. It was a political, you know, brochure case or something of that sort, as I remember. But it's really hard to get a handle, because you do get and there was the Cone case, the Skank case in New York. That was one of the early cases in this, and Shelley Hale's case, you know, the Too Much Media, the New Jersey case. So it's happening all over the place, and I don't know. It seems to me sooner or later this may make its way up to the high court.
Yes, Justin, gazing into your crystal ball and anticipating your legal practice in a few years down the road here, what do you think is the future of anonymity given what we're seeing?
Well, I think you're going to see less of it. I think we already are. Speaking about the Buffalo News, it brings to mind a paper here in Massachusetts called it's the Sun Chronicle in a town called Attleboro. It's a small local paper, and they're what they're trying out now is to prohibit all anonymous comments and allow comments only by submitting your credit card and paying a one-time 99-cent fee. So we can debate the merits of that and whether or not, you know, that will ultimately succeed or drive traffic away. But I mean, you have to wonder, you know, as a publisher of a news site, with all of the potential headache that anonymous speech can bring in. Why would you bother? Why would you go through all of that hassle? And from a practical perspective, I think that's a question that many are probably asking. Personally, I think it's troubling because anonymity is a right that we all have. It's an important one. It's one that should be protected. It's one that is protected. And I think if I could look into my crystal ball and keep my fingers crossed for anything to occur, I would hope that through these decisions, there would develop far more consistency as far as which tests should be applied when. I think that would go a long way in solving a lot of the problems that we're dealing with right now.
Yeah, that's a real challenge, for that consistency, because oftentimes the various states will have different pleading standards. And, for example, Illinois, is a fact pleading jurisdiction. So you've got to come to court with a lot of detailed facts just to survive any old motion to dismiss, not, even getting into the grounds of some kind of motion to quash a subpoena or whatever based on a lack of particularity of evidence. Whereas in federal court, you've just got the notice pleading and you can be much more general, much more, vague about the allegations. So I certainly agree with you, Justin, that there needs to be some standardization. And our real challenge is figuring out how to articulate that standard across our great land so that it has meaning no matter what court you're in, no matter what kind of cause of action you're actually dealing with.
Absolutely.
So after the break, which I'm going to take here right now, I want to get into the question of whether we're all about to put our internet access in the hands of the government, which can switch it on and off at will, as some people are beginning to pass around. And I've gotten several agitated email along these lines. But in the meantime, I'd like to thank our friends at Hover.com. This episode of TWiL is brought to you by Hover.com. And Hover is all about making domain registration and service simple. Over the years, domain registration sites have become more and more complicated. And I put this through to the test this morning. I have a bunch of sites, as I imagine a lot of people do these days, with GoDaddy. And, they barrage you with pages and pages of offers and services. And, it's just never been a pleasant experience to manage domains there, but they have a lot of presence and it's somewhere where you might have some domains. Well, because Hover's a sponsor of the show and I've been using their services in other ways, I wanted to go through the process of finally transferring a domain from GoDaddy to Hover. And I did it this morning in about 10 minutes using Hover's wonderful customer service, which they have a new no-hold policy for customer service calls Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern. And let me tell you how this went. I rang up Hover. There were a few rings and then a human being picked up. There was no phone tree. There was no, if you're calling about this, press 1. I got a human and I was able to explain to him. It was Alistair. Thank you so much, Alistair, for your help. I was able to explain to him that I was trying to transfer a domain and I didn't know how to do it. And I was logged into my GoDaddy site and I could not figure out how to get the site transferred over, how to get the transfer code that you need. They actually had a tutorial that was aimed at GoDaddy and said, if you're trying to transfer from GoDaddy, here's what you need to do. And they walked me through it step by step. So now I have my imetdenise.com domain transferred from GoDaddy to Hover, and it's a breeze to manage there. It's gone from having this cluttered screen to just a few basic options, all the things you need in one place. Nobody's trying to upsell me more domains or more services. It's just exactly what I need where I need it. And the other thing that they did for me this morning, and I'm very excited about this, is they transferred my, they helped me set up my email so that I have a personal domain with them. And it's, they have gone out and acquired a bunch of last name kind of domains. So I have denise.howell.net. And if you go to that spot, you will see over time, I've been accumulating a bunch of customized URLs. It provides a service for you that's like TinyURL or is good or any of the other shortening services. This one's not so much about shortening as it is about customization, but certainly, you know, denise.howell.net/twill77, which is a shortcut for our discussion points today, is shorter than the longer URL you might be using. It's really nice to be able to customize your URL that way. And of course, there's a custom email that goes along with that. I can be denise@howell.net. Well, this morning, the other thing Alistair helped me with was making that email actually interface with my Gmail account. And you can do that a couple of really simple ways. You can do it either with POP3 or forwarding. Either way, you know, all your Hover email and Gmail integrate seamlessly. You can send from either address. So rather than being dhowell@gmail.com, I can now be denise@howell.net. And it's just a much more polished and professional way to go. And Hover just makes it crystal clear and very easy and actually fun to use their site. So when you go to twill.hover.com, you'll get 10% off your new domain and the other services they offer. And I really encourage you to go check it out. It's a great service, and I'm thrilled that they're a sponsor of the show. So thank you, Hover. And we'll talk more about your services in the future. So let's talk here about this internet kill switch that has been rumored around the web lately. Now, all of this flows from the fact that there is some cybersecurity legislation that is pending. And apparently, there has been a lot of, I would say hyperbole about what is being included, tagged onto this cybersecurity bill and what it might all mean. And the emails I've been getting have been warning me that, you know, the administration's going to have the power. We're becoming a dictatorship kind of country when it comes to the government's abilities over the internet, and they can just switch things off. Have you guys been getting these, Evan? And what do you think the real story is here?
It's critical to try to find the real importance of it because, yeah, right, that definitely is very Stalin-esque, you know, to think that the president could shut off the internet. It's just kind of silly saying it. So, you know, I mean, it's important that we try to look at the important thing here and try to find what it is and leave it to, common sense or good sense to know that there is an importance in the fundamental issue of having some kind of regulation in place for there to be a backstop in the event that there is some kind of awful, very nefarious type of I don't like using this word, but I'll just go ahead and use it because we all kind of at least have some notion of what it means, a cyber attack. I mean, that's a real kind of nebulous term there. So we shouldn't be so quick to just dismiss it because the notion is silly, an internet kill switch, but to look at it in a very concerted way and to kind of join in with the frustrations that the politicians here have in characterizing this as a kill switch, because not only is it technologically unfeasible, it's also rather silly and a bit scary as well to think of it in those terms.
Right. Justin, have you been looking at the pending legislation at all? And do you think that these reports are somewhat exaggerated?
Well, I'd like to first call out one of your IRC members who said he would like to kill switch the government. I thought that was kind of funny. But this is an issue between how do you balance your national security interests with the freedoms we all have to conduct ourselves and our businesses online. And it's a balance that obviously needs to be made. And I don't want to downplay our national security interests with these reports of this, you know, this kill switch on the wall that the president can just flick whenever he wants. But there are some really, I think, large concerns with how that balance is struck. And I didn't read the entire bill. The entire bill was about 200 pages. But what I did glean from it and what I came away with was under Section 248, they outlined a number of factors to be considered when this infrastructure is in place that can deal with these cyber attacks. What factors should be considered to initiate everything? And, I mean, listen to some of these factors. we're talking about perceived threats, the potential extent of death or lack of safety, the potential impact on national security. I mean, my favorite is, quote, other risk-based security factors that the director of the program determines to be appropriate and necessary. What is that? I don't know what that is. I mean, it sounds very broad, ambiguous, and you know, again, I don't want to minimize this, our national security interests, but to have legislation that grants such powers based on those factors is really concerning to me. I read a summary of the legislation, and it makes note of the fact that the bill doesn't authorize any new surveillance authorities, but I would argue, in effect, it does. You're now monitoring our online infrastructure in a different way under these considerations, however they're to be interpreted, and you're allowing the government to intervene in ways that I don't think are very clearly defined. So again, all of this is a very important discussion to have, but getting away from the whole figurative kill switch, there are some serious concerns over how that balance is struck and what powers are exactly given under this bill.
Sounds like a death panel. For healthcare, we have death panels. For the internet, we have a kill switch. Let's see, Sheldon, what do you think of all this? And you know, is this legislation just going to get bogged down? And are these political maneuverings because we have elections coming up in November?
It's definitely a turf war. I mean, I'm not terribly concerned because I thought that first the government was going to take our guns before they did the kill switch thing. So I wasn't really worried about that. And if it was that easy to undo the, you know, just to unplug the internet, I'm sure by now I would have tripped over it and accomplished that. So I'm not really concerned. It's you know, I think part of it, I mean, it's true. You know, there were sections. I think section 18.4, if I remember, of it said that the president can declare, you know, may declare a cybersecurity emergency and order the limitation or shutdown of internet traffic to and from any compromised federal government or U.S. Critical infrastructure, information system, or network. And there's another section in there that allows the president to order the disconnection of any federal government or U.S. critical infrastructure, information systems, or networks in the interest of national security. So it's all that kind of stuff. But on the one hand, there are those who are saying that you know, this power is already there in the 1934 Communications Act. I know that there is, I took a look at section 606 CD, and it says that the president may prioritize defense or security communications, authorize government use or control of communications facilities, and suspend or amend rules and regulations applicable to any or all stations or devices capable of emitting electromagnetic radiations. So I think, you know, the idea is that somewhere in that power already, within the laws, the president may have it. And it's just, you know, this high-tech thing. You know, people are saying, well, how come they're not going after shut down, you know, the cell phone system or you know, the cell phone system. How come they're going after the internet? I mean, you know, I think as a practical matter, as Evan said, you know, the internet itself is probably, you know, too big and unwieldy a thing to be able to shut down in any real way. I mean, even if you're just limiting it to federal connections. So, you know, whether you can actually do this or not is one issue. But what I've seen mostly is played out as a turf war. There are some people saying that this should not be in the hands of the Homeland Security Office, that it should be in, you know, the intelligence community and the military, and others saying, well, you can't have it in the White House. So I think it's really kind of a pushing and shoving and finding out if it's possible, who's going to be able to do it, I think is what this is about. But it is, again, one of these, you know, August news stories, I think, you know, partly, you know, election season driven. And I don't think it's that, you know, serious. You know, I think we have other problems far more severe.
Well, I don't know if you guys remember back when Buzz launched, but a lot of people would have liked to have a kill switch for that one when it did. There was quite a bit of controversy about the way it came out and the way people's email contacts were linked up with the service and information that was shared that people did not want to have shared. There was a lawsuit that was brought about this, and it's been settled for the amount of $8.5 million. So I guess, as Tom Krazit writes over at CNET, that's the price of your mistake for privacy. It seems kind of cheap to me. What do you think, Evan?
Well, I mean, if somebody wrote me a check for $8.5 million, I wouldn't just let it fly out the car window, you know, being open. So cheap is a relative term. Mm-hmm. For Google, it's not that bad, I guess. But, you know, this one kind of caught me by surprise. I knew this litigation was going on. The fact that it settled so, you know, relatively quickly, even though Buzz came out, you know, a while ago, I've lost track.
Early this year.
Yeah, I kind of compartmentalize it with Wave, unfortunately, and so mm-hmm. you know, putting it in those rare notions of Google relative failures, I guess. So I think that Google was motivated by an incentive to keep this relatively quiet under the radar, and to just kind of make this go away before it had a chance to get worse, recognizing that its true privacy concerns go extend much further than the contours of where Buzz was able to reach into. Google has much bigger privacy issues to deal with, much bigger privacy fish to fry, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You know, with search and all the other things that might be coming down the down the pipe. So it just kind of like, I just woke up one morning and saw this and settled, and it's like, oh well, that's great. I bet we won't be hearing much more about it. Let's move on.
I'm kind of surprised we know the number, because generally parties like to make their settlement dollars confidential. Sheldon, any thoughts about whether this is the tip of the iceberg as to other more substantial privacy claims against Google? Clearly, people are concerned, not just in the U.S., but globally, with the amount of data Google has about us and the way that it handles it from time to time. What do you think about this?
Well, I think the reason why the settlement amount was made public was in part because of what's being allocated, you know, what the money is being applied for. And I mean, it's not like, you know, we're all having a big party now. I think mm-hmm. it's going to some kind of if I remember, some kind of wider, you know, public education, or they're going to do. I mean, it's going to, you know, the money was going toward something that they wouldn't be embarrassed about it. You know, it's going to like some internet privacy groups, I think, and somewhat. So that's part of it. But I think it might be you know, a symptom of, you know, as Evan was suggesting, that they have bigger privacy fish to fry. It might be we're kind of taking them off the pedestal. In the beginning, everyone marveled, you know, oohing and aahing at Google, and now you know, they can't do anything right. You know, people were complaining the other day about the logo, and it was those bouncing balls. You know, what does that mean? And people were all annoyed about. I mean, you know, I think Google is just they're under attack. You know, they obviously in Italy, they had that criminal privacy case, you know, judgment against some of their executives. You know, we have a whole bunch of, I think, about 30 attorneys general, you know, at the same time that they're hurling brickbats at Craigslist. They're also deciding how to address this Google Maps issue, which has been played up in Europe. You know, Australia's already jumped ugly on it, and Spain and a few other countries, where, you know, when they were sending people around to gather the Google Map information, they admitted that they, you know, inadvertently compiled all this other privacy stuff. And so they're under attack for that. So I think it's, you know, and they're not alone in this regard. As, you know, just last week, Facebook, which is the other, you know, like New York Yankees, Dallas Cowboy, you know, a big social media outlet that everyone's loving to hate now, they got sued in California, a class action suit, in your home turf there, about you know, for allegedly violating law of having minors promote services and whatnot by clicking on that like icon, you know, the thumbs up icon. They're being prosecuted for that. So I think it's a part of, you know, part of it is, you know, it's all connected. I think people are just going after after the big guys now because, number one, they got the money. But also, I think, you know, people are you know, getting annoyed at some, you know, everyone, every time Facebook tries to do something with privacy, they immediately go up online, all these, you know, let's quit Facebook now. And you know, and I think this is just a function of it. So Google is, I'm sure, is happy to be done with this. They show themselves to be responsive. You know, say, oh, you know, this is our bad, and here's $8.5 million, and we're going to, you know, give it to privacy groups and see where we're trying to protect your interests. So I think that that's what's at play here.
I'm glad you brought Facebook up in that context, because Venkat Balasubramani, who you know, has a great blog on his own, and he also writes over at Professor Goldman's blog a lot, talked about the Google Buzz settlement in a post from yesterday. And toward the end, he likens the terms of the settlement to what the Beacon settlement was. And you mentioned that about, you know, being this figure being disclosed because a lot of it was being allocated to these very altruistic causes and services like this. So very much both of those aspects can be mapped pretty clearly by analogy. Both of these behemoths, I like how you use New York Yankees as the franchise to compare them to rather than the Red Sox. But, you know, that nobody cares about. That, or everybody's very, very watchful as to what they're doing in terms of privacy here.
Well, we're going to take another sponsorship break here, but after that, we're going to have our tip of the week and our resource of the week, and I'm going to let Justin pick our final story for discussion today, because the school term has just started, and always love to give the law students a leg up whenever possible. So be thinking about that, Justin. But in the meantime, I'd also like to let you know that this episode of Twill is brought to you by Squarespace.com. Squarespace is the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. And again, I am a user of this product. If you go to bagandbaggage.com, you can check out my Squarespace site, which has a blog and various other modules. One of the things that they do that I really, really like is the photo page. You know, I don't know how necessary this is for everybody. Clearly, if you're someone who does web design or graphics or something where you need to represent things visually, then it's going to be very useful for you. But they do this amazing lightbox type slideshow of any photos you decide to put up. I just put up ones that I like. So it's just kind of fun for my personal blog. It has a very easy to use UI for creating and managing a website or blog, as I can attest to. It's optimized for both beginners and CSS experts. It has hundreds of design templates to choose from, and you can customize any of the designs to fit your needs. It has all-inclusive services that have several modules to build your website. There's a blog module. And again, you can locate that anywhere you want on your site. Mine is on the homepage, but if you'd like to have other information on your page and your blog somewhere down the road on a tab or elsewhere in navigation, you can do that. And it includes import and export support for WordPress, Blogger, Movable Type, and TypePad. There's a forum. There's the photo gallery we discussed. There's a form builder to collect email addresses and other information from site visitors. It's very savvy about integrating with the different social media tools that are out there. So if you want readers to be able to share your posts, tweet them, bookmark them, what have you, all of that is built in. There's amazing statistics built in. You get a really wonderful, nice visual representation of who your visitors are and where they're coming from, what they're looking at. There's permission access handling. There's cloud architecture for speed and site stability. So I guarantee you that if everyone listening right now goes to my blog, it's going to stay up because Squarespace is designed to handle that. So if you go to squarespace.com/twill, you'll get a free trial. You don't need a credit card to sign up. If you just kick the tires, decide to try it out. If you decide to purchase it, then when you go to purchase their services, you'll get 10% off when you enter the code TWILL. So thank you so much, Squarespace, and thanks to you all for giving them a try. So, Justin, what should we talk about as we close out the show?
Well, one of my favorite topics. I came across a story recently, and Evan, maybe you're familiar with it, having had it occur in Chicago. But there was an artist recently who was involved in a protest, arrested, and then charged under the state's wiretapping statute for secretly recording the audio of his arrest. And this topic is really an interesting one for me because there are about 12 states that have wiretapping statutes that prohibit the recording of others that aren't giving their consents or essentially secretly recording others. And there are no shortage of these videos on YouTube, for example, of those being pulled over by an officer and they record their arrest just to find out later that they violated the state law. Why I take particular interest in it is because I think it has a real chilling effect on citizens like me who, though I don't wear the title of journalist anymore, if I were to walk through Boston Common and see an arrest occurring and thinking that there might be excessive force using, I pull out my iPhone and record the incident, to think that I might be later arrested and charged under the wiretapping statute for this is really bothersome. And though, speaking for Massachusetts anyways, though I don't believe anyone in the professional media has been caught up in this issue, a number of individuals have, and there are some cases that are pending that hopefully will change the statute or interpret it in a way that's more amenable to its purpose, which was to protect the public under the wiretapping statute and not go after them when they might be proving themselves a nuisance to an officer's work or whatever they happen to be doing at any particular time.
Evan, do you know about this Chicago case? There was an NPR story that was about an artist who recorded his own arrest, just the audio.
Here, the
NPR is telling us it's generally legal to videotape an on-duty police officer in public, but in some states, recording the audio can be a serious crime. Are you following this artist case?
Well, I'm aware of it. I've watched it. I mean, this guy who's being arrested and prosecuted is also a very good self-promoter. He blogs about it himself. If we're talking about the same thing here, so I don't know how much he's necessarily helping his own case. But setting all that aside, you know, there truly are some problems with this issue here. And I think one of the problems with our statute here in Illinois is that it's a two-party consent statute, which means you have to have both parties' consent on the to be recording the conversation. And unlike a lot of other states who require both parties to consent, there's not an exception for recording when there is no reasonable expectation of privacy. So the interpretation is that a cop on duty would not have that or would have that expectation of privacy. So that's why it would be unlawful to record it. The big problem with this is just that it's such a straining of the it's such a strained interpretation of these statutes that really puts us in a situation where we're getting very far from the essential purposes of these statutes, which is to criminalize eavesdropping when somebody doesn't know they're being recorded, when they think it's a private conversation and that could be used against them for what other reason. The garden variety, critical mass of that, the scope of situations, like if you think of it in terms of a Venn diagram, of situations that these types of statutes are supposed to address are not overlapping with these weird situations like we're talking about here with people getting arrested and charged with felonies for recording the cops. The thing that is not there in the cop kind of situations is this enormous public interest in transparency and making sure that law enforcement does its job and it does it right without violation of our civil liberties. So if the appropriate set of facts came up where there was indeed perhaps police brutality that was captured and thrown out. The evidence of that was thrown out because of the violation, you know, under some kind of exclusionary rule, or if somebody was actually prosecuted for that when there actually is police misconduct that is captured. That kind of like what we were talking about at the top of the show with comparing it, like, what if Craigslist were successful in appellate court? It's going to take something like that to really capture the public's imagination and get the public aware of the weirdness of all of this for there to be a change and perhaps some kind of constitutional First Amendment argument to be successful.
Great. Well, I want to give you guys our resource and tip of the week. We're talking about transparency in law enforcement. The Sunlight Foundation likes transparency in government, and they highlighted the fact that there is a new Federal Register site that lays it out. It's at federalregister.gov. And for those not familiar with the Federal Register, it's sort of the daily record of what goes on in the United States government. And now it's very, very nicely laid out, sort of in newspaper kind of format, very clean, easy to navigate. And so rather than hiding what's going on with the government, it is shining some light on there. So our resource of the week is the new federalregister.gov site. Go check it out. And also our tip of the week goes back to, I was mentioning, I just transferred my domain name, imetdenise.com. And if you'd like to know why I have that domain name, it is it was a great idea by J. Matt Buchanan, who's been on our show before, some time ago. And I put his whole post on it in our discussion points at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw77. And the notion is, if you bump into somebody and you don't have a business card, you can register something like imetdenise.com and just point it at whatever you'd like. So I point mine at my blog page. But Matt took the step further of actually putting together a very professional-looking, simple business card that he just sticks up online. And he's got the CSS for that and everything in his post. So if you'd like to have a quick place to point your new acquaintances as to who you are and how they can get in touch with you, the tip of the week is that you set up something like imetdenise.com or imetmatt.com if you want to check out how the CSS works. And with that, we're going to wrap up the show. I want to thank Justin Silverman for joining us this week. It's been a pleasure having you.
Likewise. Thank you.
Tell us where folks can find you online. And I requested to follow you on Twitter, but I'm not sure if that's something that that I'm going to be allowed to do or if you'd like other people to do that too.
No, by all means. My personal website is justinsilverman.com, and you can find links to pretty much everything I'm involved in there. My blog that I created through Suffolk Law School is suffolkmedialaw.com, and there you'll find ways to subscribe to our weekly newsletter, the Week in Media Law, and other resources you might find helpful. So please take a visit.
Great. Thank you so much. And also Sheldon Toplett, thank you so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate your media law and First Amendment and net law insights.
Thank you very much. It was very enlightening. I learned a lot from you and Justin and Evan, so I certainly enjoyed it.
And folks can find Sheldon at the Unruly of Law blog and also your The Unruly of Law at Twitter. So go follow Sheldon and enjoy his insights further after the show.
Thank you.
Also with us again, Evan Brown, internetcases.com, internetcases on Twitter.
That's me. Come check it out. Follow me, all that stuff.
I'll follow you anywhere, Evan.
Thanks.
I try to whenever possible. And yes. Really appreciate you being on the show. We'll see you folks next week. In the meantime, go check out our Facebook page, facebook.com/thisweekinlaw. Answer some of our pre-show questions and I'll read your answers on the show. Thanks to everyone in the chat room too. You make this so fun and so interactive for us. We love checking out your stories and hopefully we can get to some of them. And we did that today. So I'm happy about that. All right, so folks, we'll see you next week for TWIL 78. Take care.